Hello again to our Western Bubble listeners. Here is Dario and I'm here with Balder. Very much looking forward to recording today's episode on multinational corporations within the framework of the Western Bubble. Balder, hi. Why are we talking about this topic today?
Hello, Dario. Well, multinational corporations are often seen as like the ultimate success story of liberal democracy. The efficiency of Western economies over the past 70, 80 years has never been in doubt. And the result of that is these large behemoths of economic power. The problem is that we are now creating a monster that we can no longer control, right? So the efficiency of economic behavior within liberalism is creating multinationals that are now outside of the realm of politics, that essentially can start making their own policy independent of specific Westphalian states. And the result of that is a very grave danger to our liberal democratic model.
And what are the facts?
A multinational corporation, or MNC, is a company that is registered or operates in more than one country at a time. Generally, the corporation has its headquarters in one country and operates wholly or partially owned subsidiaries in other countries. Its subsidiaries report to the corporation's central headquarters. MNCs are gaining increasingly large roles across the world. With market caps of large companies like Apple, Microsoft, or Tesla between $2 and $3 trillion. And for an example, the revenue of Microsoft is rivaling the GDP of countries like Bulgaria or Ivory Coast.
What is the bubble?
So when we're talking about these MNCs or those multinational corporations, this is not a new phenomenon, right? So this is something that the world has seen before. Companies rising to enormous, right, market powers, sometimes playing really important roles in countries. I mean, we've seen this particularly during colonialism with the East India Trading Company or the Dutch, basically twin of that.
Yeah, so whereas before colonialism, there were individuals with a lot of economic power and they would have what we would nowadays call different companies that would have a lot of influence on the civilization that they were part of. What happened during colonialism was that you now had these very large, truly multinational companies, the VOC, that's the Dutch version, which came first, I should point out, before the British East India Company, that essentially became the focus of Dutch and British foreign policy. So you had these large multinationals that started organizing the spice trade with the East Indies. There were also versions for the West Indies. And you saw that Amsterdam and London started catering towards those companies. And in many ways, there was an incestuous relationship between the multinational and the state already in that sense in the 17th and 18th century. Certainly in a country like the Netherlands, where the power of the VOC was enormous. The difference, however, between what we see in those days and now in the 21st century is that yes, these multinationals were incredibly powerful, but they were still directly linked to the Dutch state or the British state or the French state. They were still very clearly part of a national identity. And today's multinationals are no longer specifically British or Dutch or American. In fact, they find it very easy to move around depending on where the circumstances are most beneficial to them. And that creates a very new dynamic that we haven't seen before in history.
Absolutely. So you see them moving around depending on, where do I pay the lowest taxes? Where might I have more freedoms with regards to, I don't know, labor rights, with regards to unions, and so on and so forth. And the example that at least is closest to us here is the one of taxes and is the one of the likes of Amazon or Apple, basically freely moving around between somewhere Luxembourg, Ireland, the Netherlands is on the naughty list as well. Countries that basically offer them very, very low tax rates so that, you know, those big multinationals come into their cities and turn Dublin into an absolute basically heaven for young, very qualified Europeans who all move there because they get to work for Meta, they get to work for Google and so on.
Yeah, and if you look at, for example, Europe over the past 20 years, two countries that stood out in their economic success, at least in terms of GDP, were exactly Ireland and the Netherlands, but that was because they happily played this race to the bottom, right? Basically out-competing France, out-competing Germany, out-competing the United Kingdom to get the favor of those large multinationals. And that race to the bottom is extremely concerning for a well-functioning society, because the logical outcome of that is that you're going to live in a world where multinationals don't have to pay any taxes and basically have enormous power over the policymaking of specific states, which surely should be the other way around. States need to control multinationals rather than multinationals controlling states.
Mm-hmm. Now you have states basically pitching. They're pitched actually as big companies and telling them, here are the reasons why you should be, why you should have your headquarters in this country. An odd vision to have of the world, thinking that, Olaf Scholz, Emmanuel Macron, Mark Rutte are basically all requesting a meeting with, let's say, Jeff Bezos. And he's sitting there like one of those Bond villains, and the three little state leaders are basically catering to his every needs.
Yes, and we don't even need, even though I quite like the Bond villain kind of analogy, but we don't even need to think of these multinationals as evil by themselves, right? They don't have to be evil in nature to be very detrimental to the system. So because their agenda is simply not the same as the one of the French state or the German state or the Dutch state. They have a profit maximizing goal. They need to keep their shareholders happy. We did an episode quite a long time ago where we discussed this changing nature of company behavior in general, whereas maybe if you look at the 1950s, international banks were still very much concerned with being a pillar for society. That is completely gone. Companies do not see themselves as servants to society, they see themselves as servants to shareholders. And that is the very opposite of what liberal democracy should be about, right? Because liberal democracy is supposed to be about catering to the individual, is supposed to be catering to the citizens and making the life of citizens better, rather than those few large shareholders owning Microsoft or anyone else.
Mm-hmm. And this is all in line with something that we've described over the past 70-something episodes, is this increasing trend within the West, and particularly when it comes to Western leaders, of them being managers rather than politicians, leaders, right? With a vision to say, okay, I want to take the country into this direction because this is what I believe the best, this would be the best outcome for my country, and this is how we will get there. But now you have the likes of Emmanuel Macron, right? Who's very much that example of basically a businessman himself saying, oh, you know what? I'm going to manage this country very well. And one of these aspects is that, oh, this subdivision of my country, aka the employment sector, needs better numbers. So let me call for a meeting with Jeff Bezos and ask him to put, I don't know, a big warehouse or something of Amazon into France. And then the numbers will go up because there will be more employment in that area.
Yeah, and it's funny to see how now with the presidency of Macron ending that he's kind of showing some regrets about that, and he's trying to portray himself as a great visionary leader. But his identity, his policies have been exactly that. And that finds its roots in the 1990s, in the era of New Labour, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton, the New Democrats, where basically the idea was, okay, we're done. We know what the magic formula is. All we need to do is make sure is that interest rates stay low and that employment stays high and grow our GDP, and then everything will be fine. And if that is your approach, then of course a multinational promising to increase your GDP, promising to increase employment in your country by setting up a factory, Tesla in Germany, or registering as a taxpayer in Amsterdam, that is then very attractive, because you basically your life is intellectually hollow. You have no interest in the bigger questions as a policy leader, you as a prime minister or president. You're only interested in how can I make sure that next year GDP goes higher? How can I make sure that other investments come from abroad? And that means that multinationals essentially have free rein to do whatever they like. And it is a huge power shift away from the Westphalian state towards these very, very large behemoths that were created by liberal democracy.
See, you already mentioned one of those big pillars of the Western bubble, and that's the 1990s. And the West ultimately believing that it had one history and now we just need to manage this to the end, or basically for the foreseeable future. Another one of these big pillars is that we like to believe of ourselves as winners, right? That we, as the West, we have won the game of ideology and political systems, and we really like winners. And one of the reasons why we are winners is because we have the best companies, right? They simply grow so well within our liberal democratic system, in our free market economies. So this is a sign of really healthy countries and economies that we have these big, big companies, which then, right, leads to that thing of believing into your own mythology and therefore not wanting to do anything against these companies and believing that having many multinationals that basically act as, let's be honest, monopolies, that they are good things and that we should celebrate ourselves and celebrate the CEOs and the leaders of these companies.
And that can only happen because there is this leaning back and thinking, we are done. And that's the only reason why this is allowed to occur, that there is no longer a space for actual ideological conversations or content-based conversations. And as a result, anything that looks successful on the surface, like Microsoft, looks like an enormously successful company, with $3 trillion of market cap and enormous revenue every year, enormous amounts of people being employed, people look at that and say, this is the triumph of democracy. This is the triumph of the system that we have created. Whereas in reality, it is a catastrophic failure of democracy not to limit that, because no society can survive being run by a few economic behemoths that control global dynamics. And that's exactly where we're heading to, right? I'm all for successful capitalist behavior, but there need to be limits to that. Otherwise, we get into some kind of dystopian future. And there have been plenty of novels, there have been plenty of films made about exactly this, right? A future where a few multinationals basically just control everything and everyone, and there is no longer any politician to stop that. That should worry all of us.
But it doesn't, right? I mean, let's go out to the street and ask the average person living within the Western bubble, living within the West, what's your opinion of Microsoft, Tesla, and Apple, right? And it will most likely be, Microsoft, that's Skype, right? I mean, the two of us are calling over Skype now as well. That must be a good thing. Then you have Apple. Well, most people out there will have their fancy Apple iPhone and get a new of them every single year. And then Tesla is saving the planet with all its electric cars, right? So they must be good things. And I mean, right, it's a sign of their success that they are good.
Yes, because we have defined success of a liberal democracy in terms of capitalist success. And I would argue superficial capitalist success, right? Because if you truly care about capitalism, you call them already monopolies. The existence of Microsoft, the existence of Apple are not good. Ask all those small companies that are trying to sell their products on Apple Store, or that are trying to sell their products through Windows operating systems. They are facing an enormously powerful monster that limits their capitalist behavior, right? True successful capitalism is based on small, medium companies being innovative and engaging in, if you like, creative destruction, being more efficient in their products than other existing companies, etc., etc. And they are now being overshadowed by these very large monsters moving around without any national identity.
I mean, you mentioned Apple and the App Store, and I think this is the easiest to understand example of how dangerous these players are as monopolies. Is if you develop an app, let's say we developed the Western Bubble app and we want to distribute it in the App Store, before we had to basically give away 30% of our profits, right, to Apple that we make through the App Store. I mean, now they've lowered it to somewhere around 17, but that's enormously high, right? Just for access to the market space, they take 30%, or they took 30% of the revenue, and that's incredibly inefficient, particularly if you really like capitalism.
And not just that, but you have to hope that the algorithms are kind to your content. You have to hope that you're not going to be censored, because of course there are plenty of stories of, for example, specific governments not, you know, having this fight with Apple and with other large organizations about what should be allowed on the platform. And that process is based on a decision making within Meta, within Microsoft, within Apple, that is outside of the realm of policymakers, or at least increasingly outside of the realm, right? Policymakers are trying to recover some of that, but you are basically beholden to decisions that Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk make. And that is not liberal democracy. That is a dystopian future.
What's the international relations context?
When we're talking about what this dystopian future means for the world, right, about basically international relations perspective, it kind of tells us that not only are we now interacting on the global level, right, between states and maybe through international organizations, but there's different players out there now. And those are these multinational corporations. They are becoming real actors on the global stage.
Yeah. So there are a number of factors that contribute to this. First of all, it's the political leaders that no longer have the intellectual strength, and I would also argue sort of the political will to do something about it. I will never forget Mark Rutte's, my prime minister's quote that in order to get vision, you have to go to the optician, but you don't shouldn't ask him. So you've got politicians who for the past 30 years have been trained not to ask difficult questions, not to provide broad ideological narratives. Then you've got an insanely fast growth of these multinationals in terms of economic power. And you've got liberal democratic societies that don't really seem to care much. And so what you have now is a global economy that is no longer controlled by the nation state, or at least less and less so. It is being controlled by those few very, very successful large multinationals.
Hmm. Yeah. And this is, I mean, so we would think that if you have these companies that are becoming bigger and stronger players than some countries, you would think that the primary right actors in international relations would come together and say, well, okay, we are being threatened in our power. We are being threatened in our authority here. So we should maybe come together and do some, you know, a little bit of policy making, you know, that stuff that we do all day long, and maybe limit the power of these MNCs. But those efforts, I mean, we have seen some, but they are never really brought to the end. And if they're being implemented, they're usually not very effective.
Right. So academics, certainly ever since the 70s, have been developing these ideas. Everyone saw it coming, right? It's not something from the past decade. It's been happening for the past 45, 50 years. And so academics and intellectuals have been calling this out, have been saying we have to be extremely careful. And a very good example of that is James Tobin, an economist, who said, hey, the way that right now currency movements are damaging the well-being of states, we need to do something about that. That was in the 1970s. And he proposed limitations to how multinationals and currency traders should operate in a global economy. However, the political will was never there, and probably the politicians didn't even understand really the issue, because they were trained to think in terms of, hey, how do I keep business happy? Surely as a capitalist, liberal, democratic society, we need to make sure that companies perform in a thriving environment, and that is my job, and I don't need to listen to some academics who are very concerned about this, because I just need to make sure that the economy is managed properly. The result of that is an enormous divide between sort of the intellectual understanding of where the world is going and the political action that is not taken.
Mm, yeah. And I mean, I think another factor here is that it would put an end to that race to the bottom, right? It would put an end to us saying, oh, you know what, Amazon, you only have to pay 2% taxes in the Netherlands. And then Barbados coming around the corner and saying, you know, if you have your headquarters in Barbados, it will only be 1%. And that would simply put an end to this. So it kind of disincentivizes global cooperation.
Yeah, and this is one of those things that if you look at those two countries I mentioned earlier, the Netherlands and Ireland, who have benefited hugely in the short term from basically engaging in this race to the bottom, they thought, okay, this is going to be good for us. But in the long term, the damage that they are that they're responsible for to their own societies, not now, but in the next 10, 20, 30 years, is enormous. But that is someone else's problem, right? That's not a problem of politicians who are now actually in charge. And there is a very, very clear sort of game theory problem there that, yes, you can probably explain to these leaders that it's important to cooperate, to limit the race to the bottom, to impose certain sanctions, to impose certain taxes that are global. But in the short term, that is just not in the interest of your average politician.
No, because it's incredibly attractive to have, I mean, those limited, basically, tax revenues coming from this, right? Because particularly for these small countries, right, for these tax havens, it's still a lot of money that's coming in if you only tax someone with 1%. But we're just still talking about millions and billions that are coming in here to Barbados, let's talk about other small countries, the Netherlands and Ireland. That's still a lot of money, and so it's just attractive to keep that. And then, I mean, maybe some jobs will come in, and you know, these high functioning, very educated individuals will now work in your country, and they will consume, and they will basically increase consumption, and so on and so forth. I mean, it makes sense from a short-term managerial perspective.
Yeah, and 1% taxation is still better than 0%, right? So if your choice is not to have Microsoft at all, or to have them in your country with very low beneficial tax rates for them, then that's still a net positive in the short term. And I think there's also this overarching kind of culture in global policymaking nowadays, where these political leaders, you referred to it before, where they have Jeff Bezos visiting, and they, you know, believe that they have to cater to Jeff Bezos, where there's this whole thing about an old boys network trying to just make each other happy without any intellectual concerns beyond that, right? They want to be invited to Elon Musk's island. I don't know if he has an island. They want to be invited to Bill Gates's party, and there is this global kind of political elite that is now starting to be very, very chummy, very, very comfortable with the financial and economic elite. And that is bad news for liberal democracy.
And I mean, we have seen this, right? And them actively getting involved there. I mean, talking about this old boys club, but I mean, I remember the trade war that Trump kind of inflicted between the United States and China. And then it was very quickly that particularly these leaders and CEOs of these big companies kind of started attending dinners or meetings in the White House. And there was this very infamous one of Tim Cook, right, the CEO of Apple at the time, kind of being part of a meeting between Macron and Trump, right, and trying to convince Trump that, hey, this trade war might not be the best thing because, you know, my company, a.k.a. the tax revenue for your country, Mr. Trump, and all these jobs that I'm creating are really important for you.
Yeah, and there we go back to that issue that people see those companies and believe it is somehow a measure of success, whereas in reality, capitalist liberal democracy is successful because of the companies lower down, the innovation at a lower level, right? There's nothing positive from a capitalist perspective of how having some monopolies, yeah, moving around. And this is economics 101. Any economic student will learn this in their first year. The problem with monopolies, the problem with too much market power. And yet now we can no longer do anything about it because these multinationals can play different states against each other. They're no longer beholden to one state. Unlike the VOC, for example, in the 17th century, where the VOC still had to work together with the Dutch state, because they were still mutually dependent. Now Microsoft is no longer dependent on the United States, is no longer dependent on China. And so they can continue their monopolistic behavior without much punishment.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
All of this is, and we've mentioned it multiple times throughout this episode, incredibly damaging. There's a long list of problems with this, which is why this part is most likely going to be a bit longer in this episode now. I mean, the first one we already mentioned is if you believe in the liberal democratic model, and right, as the two of us do, and we, that's what we want to do in this podcast here, is strengthen that. And by taking the Western bubble thinking out of this, if you believe in this model, then having large amounts of power concentrated within companies, which we don't elect, that's dangerous. That's very concerning that suddenly these CEOs are meeting with countries' leaders all the time and are actively influencing policymaking, not only through direct contacts, but obviously also through millions and billions in lobbying.
It's the antithesis of what liberal democracy should stand for. It's exactly the opposite. It is more in line with, if you like, Soviet Russia, right? Where you had some large state companies that would control everything. And it goes against the idea of a vibrant democracy that is focused on citizens being catered to by politics, by the economic measures, giving individuals the chance to explore their own ideas, to set up a startup, to be economically productive. All of that gets undermined by these monopolistic organizations. And the fact that we're not panicking about that is something that unfortunately says a lot about our lack of ideological and intellectual understanding of what builds liberal democracy and what makes liberal democracy and capitalism so productive.
Right, and this is, I think, more the philosophical approach to it, right? The worrying about multinationals undermining the liberal democratic system. But then there's also the very real outcome of this is that by them becoming so powerful, they are actively hurting society, right? Just to start with the example of tax evasion, right? The fact that Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, and so on pay very few taxes in Germany because they pay them, through the European Union, but they pay them in Ireland or the Netherlands, means that money is being produced or consumed here within Germany, but the very few taxes are being paid in Ireland. And that's a problem here in Germany because that money should be spent here and in Bulgaria and in Slovenia and in Austria and Italy and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so this is one of those situations where you can see that these large companies no longer need to actually please the societies that they're operating in, right? And an example very close to my heart, because it happened in the Netherlands, and Unilever, the big producer of shampoo and ice creams and all those kinds of things, a huge company that used to be a union between the Lever brothers from Britain and a Dutch company. They merged, correct me if I'm wrong, but roughly 100 years ago, they merged together and they became this enormously powerful multinational. They still are that. About 10 years ago, then the Dutch government started actually trying to put some higher taxes on these kinds of large multinationals. And Unilever punished the Dutch government by basically now moving completely to London. And now Unilever is no longer a Dutch-British company. It's purely a British company. And if London becomes too aggressive in their taxation, they will move to Ireland. And otherwise, they will move to the United States. And that is such a painful observation that is okay for those companies. That it's no longer about connecting yourself with the society that you operate in, no longer connecting yourself with the society you come from, but it's purely about where can we maximize shareholder revenue in the short term. The same for Shell. Royal Dutch Shell used to be a Dutch-British company. Because the Dutch government finally tried to impose very minimal taxes on dividends, it was not a big deal. Shell said, okay, no worries, we'll move to London because we don't want the Dutch government to get crazy ideas about us having to contribute to Dutch society.
Right, I've said this a few times in the past few months, partly because of my job. I'm a big fan of these real business people, right? So the ones who own a company, right? They don't just manage it for shareholders, but they own a company and they take responsibility and they will make sure that jobs stay within certain regions. They will make sure that these regions are developing well economically. They will invest a lot. They will also sponsor a lot of things, right? That's at least my very idealized image of what a good and responsible company would do. Right. I mean, they're basically making sure that more and more money gets turned over in that region and overall wealth gets increased. But these large multinationals with their shareholders all over the world, and particularly not paying taxes. They're just sucking the money out of countries and out of places, right? They're just taking it out, almost like parasites in that sense, and are leaving, yeah, and are leaving nothing behind but their products.
Yeah, and some critical listeners might say, hey, Balder and Dario, you're exaggerating because they add value to society by providing really good products. But that's a problem. A monopolistic company does not provide as good a product as a truly competitive environment, right? So if they were to actually somehow add genuine value to society that otherwise wouldn't be able to exist, then you might have a point. But they actually do not add the value that other companies in less monopolistic situations might actually provide, right? And that is a serious problem. Some other listeners might say, oh, but Balder, they are still beholden to competition. Look at, for example, IBM. IBM used to be the dominant company in the 1980s. Everything was about IBM. Where are they now? Well, my answer to that would be IBM still exists, even though they're not as big anymore. But it's not about the name of the company. It's about these large companies dominating. So I don't care about IBM being replaced by Microsoft or by some other company. It is about these large shareholder-driven companies who have a different agenda than that of liberal democracy as a whole. And specifically, you said shareholders all over the world. Their agenda is not shareholders all over the world. It's not millions and millions of small shareholders who care about their own political agendas. It's a few very, very large shareholders who control the policymaking by these multinationals.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they're sitting all over the world, left and right. But as you said, I mean, there's very few of them and not millions and millions who will, right, in turn, I mean, profit off of these dividends and then spend them again. No, it will be with very few people. And we've talked about this extensively, what the problem is with these huge inequalities. They will just sit on their money, I don't know, spend it in Monaco or Hong Kong, right, in casinos, on yachts, on big parties, and not necessarily doing something productive with that money. Another aspect that I would like to talk about here is a lot of these current big multinationals are obviously at the forefront of research and development when it comes to technologies that are basically going to dominate the future, right? So we're talking about any form of chip manufacturing, any form of computing, and so on and so forth. And the big topic for now 2 years has been AI, right? I mean, it has been a topic since forever, but I think in the public domain, it basically is now for 2 years. And here you constantly hear about, oh, the race to the best AI, right? Which company and in turn also which country is going to get there first? Which that's the next worry on my mind. If you have these individual companies that are not responsible to anyone, maybe there's some form of association to a country, right? Oh yeah, Apple produces within the United States. So the United States would be very happy if Apple, Alphabet, or Microsoft were to develop the next big AI thing and therefore dominate the world markets in the future. Right? And then you have the same with companies in Europe, and you have the same with companies in China in particular. So here you have this huge race towards AI, which is just the same race as with the taxes, right? It's basically a race to the bottom. Is because here it's not about, okay, who can produce the best value AI to the world. But here it's more about, okay, who can get to the best AI the fastest with the fewest regulations. And so countries are basically trying to outbid each other with, okay, no, we are going to impose fewer regulations on you because it means your research will be faster and you might reach market power the first.
Yeah, so I am the least qualified person in the world to talk about AI, but the way I understand it is that AI is providing enormous opportunities for the future, but also very significant dangers. And that is not just, you know, Skynet, that's a reference from what's Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator films, right? It doesn't have to be as dramatic as Skynet, but there are significant concerns about AI, and those concerns are not properly addressed. So you now have a society that is essentially beholden to those competitive dynamics between a few large companies, and those large companies cannot be effectively regulated by the societies that they are going to have a huge impact on. You know, AI, for better or worse, is going to have an enormous impact on our society on the next 50 years. And the fact that governments have very few tools at their disposal to actually guide this is once again exactly the opposite of what liberal democracy should be about. We have governments to make sure that the capitalist system doesn't become dystopian, that it doesn't become simply a race to the bottom. And unfortunately, we are losing that political power when it comes to AI development.
Absolutely. And it's, I don't know, I mean, again, this is another Western bubble aspect, but it's largely about beating the other, right? Beating China and making sure that, okay, we have the best AI developments in the world, because if China has them, well, then that's a bad thing for us.
Yeah. And in many ways, you would almost want them to stop this silly competition with China and just focus on, hey, how can we as humanity harness everything about AI that is good and limit everything about AI that is potentially damaging and that's potentially destructive, right? And instead of doing that, because of current destructive environments that we live in, we are sleepwalking towards a future that nobody's controlling, except for maybe a few of those CEOs at the top of the economic food chain. And they are not necessarily the leaders that you want to have the decisions in their hands. You do not want to rely on the goodwill and the intellectual understanding of these economic leaders. You want, in a liberal democracy, to have that be dependent on political electives, on those who are chosen to represent us. And to be honest, you dismissed kind of these billionaires as, hey, they're just wasting the money in casinos. But then someone might say, okay, how about Bill Gates and his Gates and Melinda, Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, and he's doing a lot of good for the world. Yeah, but the problem is that he is not the person who you can rely on to make the right choices, because that's not how liberal democracy is supposed to work. So even though on the surface it seems that the Gates Foundation does some good work, no individual in a liberal democracy should hold that kind of power, because it's anti-democratic, it's anti-liberal.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not the only foundation there is, right? There's multiple billion-dollar foundations that, because they are maybe working in some form of an NGO, right, and they're doing good in the world, I mean, they're handing out vaccines or they're doing good things, right, that's still not what you want, exactly as you said, because there's no form of democratic oversight. And there's just so many dangers attached to this. And then, I mean, ultimately, right, this is just, I mean, foundations are usually just another model to evade taxes, right? I mean, I mean, how can it be that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation holds somewhere close to $50 billion?
That is enormous power in the hands of individuals. And I don't need to make the arguments that they're evil human beings at the top of that organization. I don't need to make the claim that Bill Gates is evil to show how it is detrimental to have that power concentrated around one or a few people. That is not how a well-governed society should function.
And what now?
Well, we already discussed that one way to basically fix these problems would be some form of international or global effort of policymaking, of regulation, right, with regards to taxes, also with regards to putting out clear frameworks in, for example, what direction do you want AI to develop, and so on and so forth. But that we're not seeing. And one of the reasons is, again, very closely connected to the Western bubble, is the decline of the United States. At least that there's, I mean, within the West, maybe the United States could lead the effort, but doesn't want to or can't. But certainly not globally. There's no single player big enough to lead the way and say, you know what, yes, we might benefit the most from developing AI or from these big MNCs, but, you know, for the greater good, we will push for regulations.
Yeah, so here it's useful to go back once again to the 1990s, where it seemed as if the United States was the only player in town, the US government, the White House, Congress, that everything had been figured out, and therefore that any of the, if you like, economic challenges that the 21st century would bring could be managed by a powerful US government. And now we see states being in limbo in 2024. The United States, Europe, China, Russia find it very difficult to define who they want to be and what their relationship is with other powerful states. And their competition between each other is basically giving a vacuum, a free space to multinationals to jump in and say, hey, United States, you need us. If you don't, if you're not nice to us, we will go to China, or we will go to Russia, or we'll go to Europe. And because the United States is no longer the powerful creature that it was 30 years ago, the US or no one, and no one else can do anything about that. There is no single political entity in the world that can stop it because of this decline in Western power. And again, that is something that means that the natural conclusion would be we have to work together between governments, but that would require these large countries to stop infighting and to recognize that it's not really about being Chinese or American. It's about what kind of 21st century do we want to create for the whole of humanity.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on multinational corporations. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I thought it would be appropriate to quote James Tobin, the economist I mentioned earlier, who in the 70s already proposed limits to currency movements around the world because it was obvious that there was going to be a power problem. There was going to be hugely destructive dynamics in liberal economics that could hurt societies. And he proposed this tax, these limitations on how foreign currency could be managed. And he essentially said that there were two solutions. The first was to move towards a common currency, common monetary and fiscal policy worldwide, and economic integration, right? Kind of a little bit the dream that existed in the 1990s from a liberal democratic perspective. But he recognized that that was politically not viable. You know, Europe and the United States are not going to have the same fiscal system anytime soon. And then he said, I therefore regretfully recommend the second solution. And my proposal is to throw some sand in the wheels of our excessively efficient international money markets through taxation and other such measures.